Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt and taxes and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, with a love of fantasy books and funk, and a hatred of running more than 3 miles, Dave Denniston.
My name is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, have you been considering going into private practice, maybe buying a practice, or maybe even selling your private practice? And maybe you have this feeling inside that you're unsure of what to do, who to turn to. For example, how does your practice get valued? Well, what is a fair market price? Should you sell it to a hospital system? Should you sell it to another physician or a group of physicians? Well, if you have been grappling with these kind of questions, or if you're just simply curious about them, you are going to love our next guest. He has over 25 years of experience in the healthcare industry. He's advised physician groups and hospitals on the business of physician practice, including all of the aspects of physician-hospital integration, practice mergers and acquisitions, practice valuations, and so much more. As a matter of fact, he is a frequent speaker, including at the MGMA, the Medical Group Management Association, the Healthcare Financial Management Association, and has presented numerous audio conferences on a diverse range of topics. He has actually been interviewed, had articles in a whole bunch of different places, including the Journal of Medical Practice Management, Medical Economics, Physicians Advisory, the Doctor's Digest, and so much more. And as a matter of fact, I happen to run across him because he has a new edition of his best-selling book, Time to Sell. So I know we're going to learn a ton today. Please help me welcome Randy Bauman. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you, Dave.
Well, so glad you're here, Randy. Well, first, let's kick this off. Tell us a bit about you and your journey. Where'd you grow up? How'd you get started?
I grew up in a small town in southern Minnesota outside of a place called Albert Lea. I went to college at Minnesota State University in Mankato, Minnesota. I started my career as a CPA with a large CPA firm in Minneapolis. I left Minnesota about 35 years ago, but I still have family there. I'm still a Twins fan, although that's kind of difficult the way they're playing this year.
Last 5 years, right? You're having a hard time, my friend.
It's been tough. From Minneapolis, I lived in Denver, Colorado for a few years. My daughter was born there. From there, we went to Albuquerque, New Mexico. I was chasing jobs and careers for a lot of this. From Albuquerque, I got transferred to Nashville, Tennessee, where I lived for 17 years until my daughter got out of college. Then I moved back to New Mexico for a few years, and about 6 years ago I moved to Mesquite, Nevada, which is a beautiful little town here in the desert outside of Las Vegas, about 80 miles.
So you left Minnesota and never looked back since.
Except come visit every year, but never looked back.
Well, tell me in this journey, as you had these different jobs, you've been all over the country. Did you have a passion for healthcare throughout this time? Were you a consultant evaluation expert throughout that, or what was that like?
When I was working for the CPA firm in Minneapolis, it was interesting. Healthcare clients tended to be hospitals. They had June year ends, so the audits were going to be in July and August, and you were going to be on the road to the far reaches of the upper Midwest during the summer, which was not an attractive assignment. So I didn't engage in healthcare back in those days. I got into healthcare in Colorado when a friend of mine who was CFO of a healthcare company hired me to do a consulting project for him. In fact, he still kids me about it to this day because he had to teach me the difference between an inpatient and an outpatient.
Man. So you're starting to learn about the difference between an inpatient and outpatient, and how did you happen to get more cases, or how did that come about for you?
I started doing consulting with another Minnesota company, although I was living in Denver at the time, a company called Control Data Corporation, which at the time was a Fortune 100 company. So they had a lot of different business lines, and they had something they called the Control Data Business Centers. And that was where I moved from the CPA accounting auditing side into the consulting side. I was always attracted to the consulting division of the CPA firm that I worked with in Minneapolis, because it seemed like those guys were the ones who were out there structuring businesses and doing operational improvement, structuring joint ventures, doing feasibility studies. Somebody told me once that being an accountant or a CPA with a public accounting firm is like, it's like bayoneting the wounded after the battle is fought. So the engagement I mentioned, the freelance one with my friend in Denver, led, coincidentally, it was really all just happenstance, to a job offer from a consulting firm in Albuquerque. So we packed up and moved about 500 miles south of Denver into Albuquerque, and they kidded me too about having to teach me about healthcare, but that's okay. That's where we start, we learn, and
that's
from
it.
There it was off to the races.
Hmm. And so that was a couple decades ago, it sounds like, and obviously there's been a big change in the environment out there for private practices, for hospitals. What do you see happening out there in the healthcare environment today?
We're still seeing a steady stream of hospitals buying practices.
Mm-hmm.
My company is a small company based in Nashville. We're doing between 20 and 25 practice valuations a month.
Wow.
So the activity, and that's been pretty steady over the past 7 or 8, 10 years now. About a year and a half ago, the percentage of the valuations that we were doing for hospitals were for hospitals buying practices. And a year and a half ago, we started to notice that about 20 to 25% of them, and we track this now monthly, but about 20 to 25% of the valuations we're doing, so 5 or 6 a month, are actually going the other way. In other words, instead of the hospital buying the doctor's practice, the hospital is selling those assets back to the doctor, which tells me that there is a core, maybe not a tsunami, but certainly a core of unhappy doctors who are going back into private practice. About a year ago, I had a call from a client in Des Moines, Iowa, a group of 12 doctor single specialty group, and they said, "We are not happy. We want to go back on our own." And the words that popped out of my mouth without even thinking were, "Are you crazy? Why would you want to go borrow several million dollars, which is what it would cost for to buy the assets and have working capital, pay their staff while they ramp up? Why would you want to do that?" But they were adamant. And what was interesting about that group is they had no previous experience in private practice. All of the doctors except one who had moved in from Missouri had always been employed. So they didn't really know anything about it. And they went live on their own October 1st of last year. I talked to them last week, and they're doing fine. So that's probably the biggest thing, is we've kind of got this upheaval in the market where we've got lots of doctors still selling. In fact, last week, a large group in North Carolina, 300 doctor group that we had actually formed back in the 90s through a merger, and they've grown from 50 doctors to 300. They actually sold out to a hospital system. And on the other end of the spectrum, we've got these doctors like the ones I mentioned in Iowa saying, "I'm not doing this anymore," and they go back on their own. So all of this, I think the message from that is each market is unique. Healthcare is local. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So in some markets, prices are down. In some markets, prices are up. It's really very specific to the market.
How interesting. Well, I know that you hear about these numbers you're just throwing out, right? A few million dollars to get back in private practice, and it can be a scary proposition of doing that when you're used to having basically most everything come up for you and you just punch the clock and punch out and go to work and do your thing. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about assembly line medicine and burnout. Well, what do you make of that, you know, in terms of private practice? What are some of the pros and cons that you see happening out there?
I think there are some trends that are positive, but overall, I think it's very difficult for a doctor to establish a private practice. The capital is available.
Tell me more about that. You know, why do you think that is?
I think just the sheer amount of the investment and the expertise you need to be in compliance with all the regulations makes it very difficult. I think all of these initiatives on population health management and quality of care and the shift from volume to value that we read about, all these acronyms that are out there and the things that came out last week about doctors choosing a different track of how they're going to be paid, I think all of these things are going to be very difficult for small groups to navigate. On the positive side, I guess I would add, there are some positive trends. Capital's available, interest rates are low, as I said, and there's some pretty cool alternatives out there for what I call pay-as-you-go electronic health records and systems like that. Now, these come with a cost, but it's a pay-as-you-go cost, and sometimes a pay-as-you-go cost is a whole lot better than investing 70, 80, 100,000, whatever. I've seen some pretty big numbers for software licenses and hardware up front. So I think there's some cloud-based alternatives that can work in some situations. I know that's an option that the group in Des Moines chose.
Well, I know it's a tricky spot. I heard of a local physician that I was speaking with, and his group was basically being forced to sell because they were in the red every year. I think they have probably 8 to 10 different locations, and they're pretty much one of the only two games in town. And it was just fascinating that from his perspective, dealing with the ACA and some of those requirements, you know, it really created a burden for them that they couldn't keep up with. Yet I hear from other physicians that are starting kind of solo shops, you know, just them, that maybe they're cutting ties with insurance companies or taking more cash payments, more concierge, kind of local doc medicine. And it seems like those two models are really so far apart in terms of how people are doing business.
Well, I talk about this a little bit in the book where I talk about alternatives other than selling your practice. But concierge medicine is something that I think is exploding in many states. And I don't know what it is where you are, but I did some numbers in the book on this, but if the average, and these are just off-the-cuff numbers, but if the average family doctor brings in $500,000 in revenue or $550,000, maybe six, and his overhead is 60-70%, he's probably got 2,000 or 3,000 patients. He's seeing 15, 20, 25 patients a day for 10, 12, 15 minutes. 30 minutes would have, right? 100 patients. They get a couple thousand dollars a year per patient, so that would be $1,000,002. You do the math. I think it's a slam dunk. The trick is to find the right demographic, because a certain part of your practice, if you have an established practice, is going to be very mad at you if you convert to a concierge practice. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you only need somewhere around a quarter probably of your patient base to convert, and the demographic is perfectly ripe. I say I'm a ripe demographic. I'm 60 years old. The ripe demographic is people between age, say, early 50s to age 65. I'm already paying a fortune for health insurance, and it doesn't cover anything. My copay is $50 for two visits a year, and after that it goes to my $5,000 deductible. How does a small practice even figure out my health insurance is You know, think about it. That's complicated. They're used to collecting $25 every time you come in. Well, gee, after Randy comes in twice, now it has to go to his deductible. We need to collect more. How much? It's very confusing. I would gladly pay $150 a month, about $2,000 a year, to have a doctor available 24/7 who will spend a half hour or an hour, whatever he or she needs, who's available by text, email, cell phone, really? I was actually looking for one in Las Vegas. Las Vegas is about an hour from here. But I'm actually looking for one because we're not getting the care otherwise. I'm waiting 3 days to see a nurse practitioner. Luckily, I'm very healthy, so it's not something that's at the very top of my list, but I think that's a huge opportunity.
I think, imagine...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think certain areas of the country particularly would be more conducive to it. California or Arizona or Florida or Texas, you know, those warmer places where a lot of retirees go to. And, of course, there's opportunities throughout the whole country. Are you seeing that at all, you know, geographically? Is concierge medicine popping up more in certain places than others?
Absolutely. I tried to find one in New Mexico when I lived there a few years ago, and there wasn't one that I could find at that time in the whole state. We had a family doctor here in Mesquite. Mesquite's a little town of about 18,000 on a good day because there's a lot of snowbirds here who leave, obviously, for the summer. But we had a family doctor here who sold his practice to the hospital and then quit and said he was going to start a concierge practice, and he failed. And he failed because he didn't market it. Marketing is kind of counterintuitive to many physicians. I didn't know that he was offering this, because if I would have known, I probably would have signed up. But I didn't find out until after he already went to work for a hospital in Las Vegas. So, yeah, it's very specific to the demographic.
Interesting. Well, let me kind of pivot back, and let's talk a little bit about acquisitions. I was telling you before we started recording that I had made an acquisition, and we had some bumps along the way. So tell us about a time that you've seen an acquisition that happened really super smoothly. You know, what happened? What led to that?
I think always, and I talk about this a lot in the book, there's a chapter on choosing the right partner. So if you're going to sell to a hospital, choose the right partner, because it always, the ones that go smoothly, Dave, always come back to trust and honesty, and those two go together. Mm. If I trust somebody, I believe they're honest. And that's really the key. Everything else can be worked through, the financial issues, the operational issues, the autonomy issues, the benefit issues. Every issue can be worked through if there's that trust level. But if there's a lack of trust, who knows what you're going to get? I could tell you stories all day, because a lot of times there's not trust between a hospital and a group of physicians. And there's a lot of history. A lot of time there's a lot of turnover. I always say turnover in C-suites of hospitals can be pretty rapid. So you want to make sure the person you're negotiating with is going to be there, because if they're not, somebody else is going to come in, and they're not going to honor all these verbal agreements and verbal assurances that, oh, no, don't worry about that. We won't move your office, or we won't make you fire your office manager, or it's fine if your wife works there, whatever the situation is.
So that level of trust, well, I got to imagine that both parties are fairly wary of one another, having been perhaps heard horror stories or burned in the past. So how do people get that level of trust? Tell us about an instance where they were able to really have that. You know, how did that come about?
The trust comes about at some core level. At some core level, hospitals and physicians are competitors. At some level, they're competitors.
Sure.
At another level, the hospital is just a workshop. They used to call it the workshop model. I used to do an HFMA speech on this, but a hospital was a workshop. You provide me a workshop, I come in, I use your tools, I use your staff, I use your operating rooms, I use everything for free, And by the way, you should buy me lunch and bow down to me when I come in the door. So it was a workshop model. But as the world changed and reimbursements changed, doctors and hospitals became more natural competitors. From the basic, I remember a primary care doctor doing x-rays in his office 25 years ago. I mean, this was just, the hospital was aghast. That evolved over time, clear studies in their office. And I worked with hospitals that were surprised at that. And I said, really? Well, that's because you live in South Carolina, but in the rest of the country, almost every cardiologist does nuclear studies in their office. So this competition built up. And I think that's very difficult to overcome. So to answer your question, I think where you have the honesty and trust is where you have a history of collaboration, of working together and having whatever you're working together on, a joint venture, collaborative on patient care, coordination of care, whatever it is. Where that's working, I think there's that level of trust, number one. Number two, as I mentioned it a minute ago, it's stability of leadership. Stability of leadership. So if you have some history of working together, and when I think of the successful ones that went very smoothly, that was what was present. And when I think of those that blew up after 2 years or a year, or I had one a couple years ago in Colorado. It's a large acquisition. A hospital had a large clinic across the street, literally across the street from the hospital. They'd been competitors for 40 years. And it was about a 50-doctor clinic. They never could get over the trust issue because they were so used to fighting this battle. They were like the Hatfields and McCoys. They were always peeking around the fence to see if the other guys were going to take a pot shot at them. And we spent 2.5 years with lots of attorneys and consultants and valuation experts and compensation people and operational people trying to figure out how to integrate these two. And at the last minute, and I know the hospital had to be in it for over seven figures, at the last minute it just blew up because the group didn't trust them. And the group sold to a competitor, which was 20 miles away, would not have been my first choice as a competitor that they would sell to, but the competitor offered so much more money, and they didn't have that distrust. And that was really the difference. It wasn't the money so much as it was the distrust. They just didn't trust the CEO who had been there a long time. They didn't trust the board, and that's what happened. So those are the characteristics that I see.
Well, it sounds like, let me see if I captured this right, that what I heard coming from you was it's almost like you got a date before you get married, and those relationships where you've built it up over time seem to be much better acquisitions where you've done some things together, you've mentioned joint ventures together, where you've had a chance to feel each other out, so it's like, let's go on a few dates before we get married. Is that fair?
Exactly. That's a real good analogy.
All right. Good. And it sounds like that the challenging situations have been where they have been adversarial at times, and to overcome that is difficult.
All right. Well, let's take a pause here for a second and go to our commercial break. Well, if you are like some members of my audience, you are committed to being an amazing doctor and succeeding at life. But the truth is, you've never received financial training during medical school, and you struggle with enough time to do it all. So if you are someone who hasn't really taken the time to take the approaches that we talk about in the podcast, and you want to take time to crack the code, you want to hit the sweet spot financially, through only the end of August, I am picking a handful of people and doing a diagnostic strategy session for each of them individually. And this is where we take a look at your finances, give you some high-level ideas on what could work for you, and things that could help you hit that sweet spot financially. So if you're interested in applying, you can email me at dave@daviddeniston.com or visit the podcast website at www.drfreedompodcast.com/coaching. And don't let this podcast be like other ones where you have great information, you get these new ideas, but you never actually complete anything. If you're sick and tired of doing that, it is time to get on one of these calls with me and get yourself financially to the next level. To apply now, email me, dave@daviddeniston.com, or visit www.drfreedompodcast.com/coaching. Again, that's www.drfreedompodcast.com/coaching. And now back to the podcast.
Well, in a recent podcast episode, I talked about the 10 most challenging years of my life, and I chronicled this time that I made my first acquisition. It was this huge leap of faith, and to be honest, I made some huge mistakes, and there's so many things I would change if I did it all over again. And, you know, I believe successful people learn from their mistakes, but super successful people learn from others' mistakes. So tell us more about a time where a merger or acquisition went horribly wrong.
Back in the, I want to say it was the mid-90s, it was a while ago, we were doing group mergers. I mentioned the one that grew up to 300 doctors and sold out a couple weeks ago. Well, we did a similar group in the same part of the country. It was in the southeast. It was about 22 doctors, and it was our first one. And one of my partners, one of the founders of my company, he left along many years ago. We're still good friends. We talked the other day, but he was good at getting the doctors together. We merged 20 groups, in this case about 45 doctors, multi-specialty group, and he just loved the art of the deal, he called it. He'd pull them together, and but he would make a compromises to get it done. Well, what will it take for you to join, Dave? What will it take for you to join, Randy? Well, I'm not signing a non-compete. So he crossed off the non-compete. There was no non-compete. Now, when you're merging a group, you're creating this new entity that's going to invest, at that time, it was about $1 million in infrastructure for an IT platform and things like that. You're making a commitment to go into business. So we tend to look at a non-compete as an individual, but in a merger, when we're merging our businesses together, we have to look at it as a way to protect the business, because the business is what we're investing all this money in. So the group gets together. There's no non-compete, or what I call glue, holding them together. A few years go by, and the going gets tough, and one of the specialty groups pulls out. You know what? Here's your 90-day notice. In 90 days, we're gone. In a medical practice, all the costs are fixed. So within 6 months of their departure, the entire group just collapsed, because you can't cut the overhead fast enough to make up for losing, I think it was 7 or 8 high-producing specialists. And it fell apart. And after that, our mantra was never again, because as you said, you learn from your mistakes. We're not compromising on glue. If I can't tell you how many times I've sat in those steering committee meetings of mergers after that, and there's always a doctor who thinks he knows everything and is trying to unwind the merger. And I would turn to him and say, doctor, we're going to have a non-compete. If that's a problem, then this probably isn't for you, and that's okay, because we're not all homogeneous. We don't all have to be the same, but this business model does not work without a non-compete. So that was one where we really learned from our mistakes.
And that glue, the non-compete, essentially, my understanding of that, and correct me if I have this wrong, the non-compete is the agreement where you're saying that if you leave the group, you cannot be practicing in a given area. It's pretty standard in most contracts that I've ever seen for physicians or even for acquisitions. So essentially, if you don't have that, someone can start a brand new practice right next door in the same building on a different floor if they have the capabilities of doing so, right?
Right. They take your staff. They take your patients, which they think are their patients. Okay. They probably are their patients. They brought them to the merger. But again, you don't agree to get married with the idea that you're going to get divorced and that you can just walk away. That's not how a divorce works either. I'm sure a lot of physicians have experienced that, but that's
right.
Not how it works. You don't get to just walk away.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't have to be a non-compete either, Dave. I call it glue because in some situations, it, you know, a non-compete, we probably don't want to have a non-compete, or in some states a non-compete isn't even enforceable. And I say this in the book, you have to be, California doesn't allow non-competes. Tennessee had a court case a few years ago that pretty much eliminated non-competes for physicians, and they keep trying to tweak it to figure it out. So you have to have good legal advice. But in one group I'm thinking of, we did up in Pennsylvania, the glue was that you agreed that you could leave, you could compete, you could do whatever you wanted, but you agreed to pay your share of what became the, we called it the corporate overhead of this new corporate office that was created to manage, in that case, that was a similar group, about 45, 50 doctors. They're hiring a CEO, a CFO, a chief operating officer, a HR person. They're buying computers, renting office space, creating all this incremental overhead. You agreed to pay your share of that for a period of time after you left. You could compete. Well, that was a deterrent. It was glue. But if you think about it, we didn't really care if they competed. What we cared about is that we had enough capital, operating funds, to sustain the business if doctors started to leave. And that worked pretty well, too.
Interesting.
I don't recall that anybody left that group, but if they would have, the group would have been able to survive, unlike the one I mentioned before that just collapsed under the weight of its own overhead.
Isn't that something? So it's what you're talking about is essentially a monthly commitment that someone signs up for. And can that change, that monthly commitment? Is it based on the last 12 months, or is it set at the initial part of the contract? What does that look like?
Well, a group like that, a large multi-specialty group, will have what's typically referred to as a compensation model or a compensation plan, or some people call it an income distribution plan or IDP. But it's basically a model of how the overhead is allocated. And usually it's I always say there's three types of compensation plans in multi-specialty groups. There's the one you had last year, the one you have now, and the one you're going to have next year. They tend to be very complicated. But there's always a line in there for allocation of those corporate costs, administration, HR, billing, things like that. So whatever that allocation was, you agreed to pay your share of it for a period of time after departure. And if I'm remembering right, it was about 18 months to 2 years. So that would give the group a chance to resize itself, restructure that overhead, recruit new doctors, add new services, whatever it took to sustain itself.
How interesting. Huh. Very good. And now when someone makes an acquisition, if they're like this private group you were talking about earlier where they were in a hospital setting and they wanted to start out on their own, with you mentioned interest rates being so low, that being an attractive environment, where are people or how are they getting the capital, the debt, the equity to fund an acquisition today?
Hospitals, when they're doing acquisitions, are typically funding, well, out of cash flow or capital reserves. The one I mentioned a few minutes ago that went on for 2.5 years in Colorado, that hospital was going to fund it with a special tax-exempt bond issue. Now, it was a pretty expensive acquisition. Overall, it was probably in the $25 million range. So it was significant, but I always kind of scratched my head when the CFO of the hospital would talk about this, because I knew what the pro forma loss was on this group, and it was several million dollars, and it didn't really seem to me that that would be an easy investment. Here, why don't you invest in our $25 million bond issue to buy this group practice so we can lose whatever it was, $5, $10 million a year on it? It kind of had me scratching my head. But the other side of that, especially for small practices, what we're seeing in the market is they're buying hard assets, furniture and equipment. That's pretty much it. So these aren't large dollar value acquisitions. Now, the 300 doctors that I mentioned earlier, yeah, that was probably a pretty sizable acquisition. And given the speed that that deal got done, my expectation is, I wasn't involved in it, but my guess is it got funded by this large university-based health system out of operating reserves. That's my guess. So On the private practice side, debt capital is readily available. The group in Des Moines, I said, the first thing we need to do is we need to talk to the bank, because we need to know what flexibility they have and what interest rates we need to build into it. Because the first thing we did was a feasibility study of what the group would look like if they pulled out from their hospital employment and went back on their own. And you can imagine a long list of questions. Will the payers contract with us? What will the rates be? What's it going to cost us to hire a practice administrator? How are we going to do billing and collection? They already owned their building, so that one was pretty easy. They just had to unwind their current lease with the hospital. The banks were like competing with each other, and this was just about a year ago, so it's not like this is ancient history. The banks were competing with each other, throwing money at it. We were pushing them on terms and collateral, and we even were able to push them on the level of personal guarantees they were requiring. So let's
walk through that real quick. Let's walk through that real quick, Randy. So these terms of the loans that you're talking about, what sort of things were they able to negotiate? You know, you mentioned the interest rate, for example. What were some of the give and takes that – obviously, the bank is looking for a certain rate of return or a certain collateral or whatever. Tell us about that process more.
Well, the biggest borrowing need in starting up a group is what we call working capital. Working capital is enough money to pay the practice overhead and, in all likelihood, unless the doctors have a lot of money in savings, to pay the doctor's salaries for a period of somewhere around 2 to 4 months, because that's how long it's going to take for the accounts receivable that are generated from the patients they see from day one. Once they start as an independent practice, they generate charges, but it takes time for those receivables to turn over and for their cash flow, their cash collections to stabilize. We call that the accounts receivable ramp-up period, and it's usually, depending on specialty and payer mix, it's usually somewhere from 2 to 4 months. And it's a very risky thing when you do this, because you're dealing with getting recredentialed with some of the payers. It varies by state. In Iowa, it turned out that was easy. You're looking at getting new Medicare numbers and assignments in place, and we all know from dealing with Medicare that can be a crapshoot. So you want to make sure you have enough reserve in your collateral of your line of credit, because you're going to fund this working capital through a line of credit typically, and that's going to be secured by your accounts receivable. So let's drill into that side of it, because this is getting to your question where there's negotiation. So the bank in that case, and these are close, but they're probably not exact. The bank said, well, we typically loan 70% of accounts receivable less than 90 days old. So they look at our accounts receivable and say, this is how much we'll loan you. Now, we're only going to loan you 70% of what's outstanding for less than 90 days. So on day one, that's not very much. But after a couple months, it's a sizable amount of money. And the group says, well, I said to the group, I said, we really need a little more cushion than that. Let's try for 80% of receivables outstanding less than 120 days. And one of the banks said, sure, yeah, we'll do that. So part of the financial model is to look at what that means. I call that debt capacity. So our debt capacity is X, which is 80% of accounts receivable outstanding less than 120 days. Here's how much I project we have to borrow based on what I feel the cash ramp-up of those receivables is going to be, and here's the cushion. In other words, the unused debt capacity. So if things really go bad and Medicare doesn't pay us for 6 weeks, we can weather the storm without having to cut people or not take a paycheck ourselves, because you alluded to this a few minutes ago, Dave, but in a small practice, you make what's left over. And if there's nothing left over, then you're not making anything. And that's what's scaring those doctors you were mentioning about when you said they're going to have to sell because they're not making it. That's why. So that was one example of what was negotiable, and I got some others if you're interested.
Yeah, please do. Run us through that real quick.
There are another interesting thing that a lot of doctors don't know is that the level of personal guarantees that a bank requires can be negotiable as well. So let's say I'm a solo doctor. I have a corporation. I go to the bank. I say I want to borrow money for my corporation. The corporation signs. The bank says, well, that's real nice, Dr. Randy. We like your corporation, but you know what? We like your house, too, because you have equity in it. And if your business fails, we're going to make you put your house at risk, so you sign what's called the personal guarantee. Personal guarantees come in three forms. There's just a basic personal guarantee, which means you guaranteed 100% of the debt. Or there's a guarantee called joint and several guarantee. This applies when there's more than one doctor, right? It's pretty simple when it's just Randy. But if it's Randy and Dave, and we're going to go into business together, what would you think joint and several means? Well, joint and several means legally that you and I are each responsible for 100% of that debt.
Hmm.
And you say, the first thing anybody says, right? Wait a minute. The bank has collateral for 200% then, 100% from Dave and 100% from Randy. Yep, that's what joint and several means. So what we try to negotiate is something in the middle where the bank is willing to take something less than a 200% guarantee. And that's where the negotiation comes in, is you can usually negotiate down that percent with the group in Iowa. We got it down to about 50%. Now, there were, if I'm remembering right, there were 12 doctors, so they were each responsible for half, but still, that was a whole lot better. That was 600% instead of 1,200%. So that's the other thing that's typically negotiable.
Isn't that something? Huh. So
and the bigger
I guess
the group, the more leverage you have for that, because the bank wanted this group as a client. They'd been in the community forever. They knew the doctors. They knew they had the patients, which is the first risk factor, right? If you're going to start a business, I always tell doctors, you know, y'all complain you're too busy and you got too many patients and you can't fit them in the schedule. I say, you know what? I would like to have that problem. Sometimes I've had it and, you know, I'm being funny, obviously. I don't really want to have that problem because I can't serve all my clients, and they don't want to have it either, which is why they're complaining. So the bank knew the revenue would be there. The question was, would they be able to collect it? They could generate the charges. So that's where the risk was, and I think the bank looked at it and said, you know what? This group's been here forever. We think they're going to be fine. They may have some hiccups. It's our job to bridge that for them, and we're glad to take some risk to do it because we don't really believe it's any risk anyway because we know those receivables will be collected eventually.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like obviously the larger the practice, the more leverage you have. The smaller the practice, the less leverage you have. Is that fair?
That's fair, but remember that any doctor is going to be an attractive client to a bank. Hmm. Any doctor is going to be in the top 5%, say, of a bank's clients. So they love doctors because doctors deposit a lot of money, they have a high earning capacity, they take out home mortgages, they might have investments, they're going to have pension plans. They like doctors. So even a solo doctor may not have the kind of leverage we're talking about with 12 or 20 or 30 doctors, or let alone 300, but they do have some sway.
Well, that's great. Interesting. Well, I did mention in the intro you have your new revised edition of your book, Time to Sell. Tell us all about that.
I originally wrote Time to Sell in 2008 when we had started seeing this cycle of hospitals buying practices take off again. We saw this in the 90s. It's one of the advantages of being older. You've seen things. You say, wait a minute, I've seen this before. I think I've seen this movie before. I think I know what's going to happen next. And we've all had that feeling watching a movie, and sometimes I feel like I'm watching a movie. So in 2008, hospitals were buying practices. We were doing lots of valuations again. So I wrote a book about it. In 2011, I updated it with a second edition to talk about regulatory changes and really changes in the market. There is a market for physician practices. Now, it varies, as I said earlier, all healthcare is local. So a doctor emails me last week and says, I'm in Santa Clara, California. What's the market for my practice? And my answer is, well, I worked close to there, but I can only tell you what that hospital is paying. I don't know what your market is. But he had this idea that there's this market out there and I'm going to get 50% of my revenue as goodwill or 100% of my, I don't know what he was thinking, but I said that it's very local and depends on the competitive environment, who owns the hospital, because many hospitals are part of larger systems, and these policies are dictated from above. I know some of the large for-profit hospital ownership companies in Nashville dictate from above whether or not individual hospitals all across the country are able to pay for goodwill or an intangible value or medical record or a trained workforce or whatever the question happens to be. This is dictated from a higher pay grade. In Iowa, the healthcare system that owned that hospital was out of Denver, huge Catholic system. They tell them what they're able to do. So that's a long way of saying this changes. And so the new book, the third edition, which updated for all of those things, came out last week. And I think it was very important because I think one of the coolest things about the new book is, the new edition is, I codified, so to speak, what I call this cycle of physician employment that I've kind of been alluding to, because we do go through a cycle. So if I've got a hospital right now in Michigan and they're a client and they're just starting to buy practices, they're just buying them up left and right. Every doctor in town all of a sudden has decided in 2015 and 2016 that they want to sell their practice. I don't know what's going on up there, but that's the market in that town in southern Michigan. So I call that phase one. That's the acquisition phase. In the acquisition phase, and this is the important part for your listeners who are looking to sell a practice, you need to know about your hospital. Choose the right partner, as we talked about before. You need to know where they are in the cycle, because if they're just buying, they're just starting, the odds are they're going to be pretty flexible. They want to buy them up. That's what happens in the acquisition phase.
Well, part of it, too, I imagine, Randy, is we talk about, for example, in stocks, you know, how liquid is your market to sell a given position. And if there haven't been much in the way of transactions, it's a lot more difficult to value it in someone's area versus someone where there has been a lot of transactions. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, and besides your book, Time to Sell, what are some other good resources, some books or blogs or podcasts or courses that you would recommend to physicians out there that are interested more in this subject?
Well, I think if I could just backtrack just briefly, the rest of that cycle then is there's the phase two, where it's what I call the operational development phase, and that's a phase where a hospital has a lot of practices already, and they tend to centralize things. They tend to standardize things, and a lot of independent physicians don't like that. And then as they start to lose money, and most hospitals lose a lot of money on these employed physicians, and if you're interested in selling and you find a hospital that's in what I call phase three, which is the restructuring and divestiture phase, you can guess how they're going to look at an acquisition. They're saying, well, we're not really doing real well owning these doctors. We're losing $200,000, $300,000, whatever it is, per doctor per year. It's hard for us to go to the board, Dr. X, and say that we need to have some more money to invest some more in these losing assets. So if what I say in the book, and really kind of the premise of the new material in the book, is to say, wow, know where your hospital is in the cycle, because that'll tell you what you're going to get. So if you've got a group that wants to sell and the hospital isn't doing real well with already operating what they already own, they're likely to going to be a lot tighter when it comes to what they're willing to pay in terms, not just in value, but in terms of compensation as well. And both of those, as you know, are subject to fair market value constraints, but there's nothing in the law that says they have to pay fair market value. They can certainly pay less. They can't pay more, but they can certainly pay less, and believe me, a lot of these systems are. And that's why the group in Iowa wanted to go on their own, because the hospital wanted to cut their pay somewhere around 20 to 25%. Well, nobody's going to do the same job for 25% cut in pay, I don't think. You'd have to be pretty desperate, right? Or you'd have to be making a real lot of money and you could afford the cut.
Yeah, or there'd be some other back-end kind of component to that that's attractive enough to have you want to do that.
Yeah. To answer your question about resources, I met this lady about 15 years ago at an MGMA conference. Her name is Nancy Collins at Green Branch Publishing. She's the one who's published my books. I've actually got another book that's in pre-production right now. It's called, tentatively called, Choosing Autonomy, Guide to Reestablishing Private Practice. And it's a short guide that I've written based on a lot on the experience in Des Moines of helping doctors who say, I really can't work for a hospital, I want to go back on my own. That's what this book is for. I think it's probably a limited market, but I do think that it's very valuable for people. And Green Branch has a plethora of resources available that I'm just amazed by. Nancy's a great lady, but they do something, for example, called Fast Practice, which is a monthly executive summary of important articles that have been written about the business side of physician practice. So, you know, who has time to sit around and read all these journals? Well, they summarize it for us. So I love that. I love their Journal of Medical Practice Management, which comes out every other month in print form. They do a whole library they have of books and e-books on just about any topic you can think about, whether it's selling a practice, as is the case with my book, or managing your online reputation is one of them, where patients
Kevin
are posting
Pope.
Bad things about you on all of these health grades type websites that are out there. There's webinars, special reports. It's really amazing the breadth of information they cover, and I know a lot of their authors. I've gotten to know them over the years. They're just a great group of people. So that's my go-to resource if I want to know something about how to manage HIPAA compliance, is I go to Nancy's website, greenbranch.com.
Greenbranch.com. Got it. Well, there's obviously so much we could talk about in this area, and we just simply don't have time to cover it all. So do you have any closing thoughts that you think people should be aware of, Randy?
I think it's a tough market out there, and I think you need to be very wary of jumping in too fast. I've always said that healthcare, and you get this by working in the industry for as long as I have, but there's always some new next best thing, some new acronym, and most of them that I could throw out to you right now, like, I don't know, does anybody remember PSAs? Those were a relic of the late 90s, early 2000s in some Medicare law that doctors were going to go be able to negotiate price collectively. Mm-hmm. And those never got off the ground. There's always some new thing. There's lemming behavior, I call it. So I always say, walk cautiously. If you're going to sell your practice, make sure that you have a way out, because some of these networks aren't going to survive. They're losing too much money. If you're going to merge, don't ignore things that disturb you. If you're not getting along with one of your colleagues that you're going to merge with, that's akin to getting married when things aren't working out in advance. There's a reason that they call it an engagement period, right? It's a way to see if it works.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Randy. That's just great advice, great mentorship. And if people have more questions, how can they get in contact with you?
My email address is my initials, R as in Randy, B as in Bauman, rb@deltahealthcare.com. Our website is www.deltahealthcare.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. I think my LinkedIn is Randy R. Bauman.
Perfect.
And you can always do, from the website, you can email me that way as well, or call the office. We have a voicemail system. It forwards your message on to me within a minute, and I'll get it on my cell phone. And I usually call people back as soon as I get off the plane. So.
Wonderful. And where can they find a copy of Time to Sell?
Time to Sell, third edition, is available at Amazon.com. Make sure you get, just search for my name, Randy Bauman, and it should come up. Make sure you get the third edition. The second edition was still listed there last week, and the publisher told me it sometimes takes Amazon a few months to get the second edition down. You want the third edition. It's got a red cover. The other ones have a green cover. Or you can go directly to the publisher, greenbranch.com, to their online store. And same thing, search for my name, and it should come right up.
Perfect. Well, again, it's an honor to have you on. And I just want to say to everyone else out there, if you're a physician and you want to tell your story, you're grappling with tough issues like this one, you want to get on the soapbox for a few minutes, I'd love to share it too in the next Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Make sure to contact me, Dave, at daviddeniston.com or on my website, drfreedompodcast.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes. Check in again soon. Also, if you got some tremendous value from this podcast, I would like to ask you a favor. Could you please take a quick minute and do a review on iTunes? It really helps the show and would mean a lot to me. Again, this is Dave Denniston. Thank you so much for joining us. Check in again soon. Have a good one.